a little bit disconnected, I guess. We had kind of three much more hard and fast segments than we normally do. So I was just going to open it up here as we start out. Does anybody have any questions from all that? Because we covered a whole lot of ground. Yeah, I guess I mean, I could. I don't think I can do that. I think let's go ahead and we'll pick up kind of where we left off and move forward. And it'll be a little bit more connected, I think, to do it that way. So let's open up to start here with Joshua chapter 24, verses 29 to 33. Joshua 24. And so if you remember last time, we started out talking about the covenant renewal at the beginning of Joshua, where Joshua goes and he tells the people, you know, this is what God has done for you to this point. And so we get this recap of all of this, all of these glorious things that God has done at the beginning of Joshua 24. You know, how God picked Abraham and brought him out and sent them into Egypt and then rescued them from Egypt with the plagues and all of this brings them to, totally drawing a blank here. Mount Sinai gives them the law, gives them all of this stuff, sustains them as they travel through the wilderness, despite the fact that they're being less than faithful to him. And through all of this, we get just the graciousness of God. And because of this graciousness, there are certain things that the Israelites are supposed to do. And that's kind of the law structure that we find in the last part of Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy in particular. And we get a little bit of a recapitulation of those here in Joshua. And if they follow those, then there are some blessings. And if they don't follow those, then there are some curses. And so they've just gone through this, and you get that famous statement from Joshua. Let me read it so I don't misquote it. Choose therefore this day whom you will serve. Must be on the previous page. No. Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and truth and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt and serve the Lord. If it is disagreeable in your sight to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served which were beyond the river or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you were living. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. And the people choose to serve the Lord. Even though Joshua tells them point blank that they will not be able to do it. And so we kind of left off then right at the end of that segment. And so now we're going to pick up with verse 29. Would somebody like to read Joshua 24, 29 to 33? 29 to the end. Anita, thank you. Yeah, verse 29 to the end. A laser. Phinehas. Very good. Thank you. So what do we see here? What has this generation just come through? Well, certainly the last time we looked at them in Deuteronomy, they were just about to cross the Jordan, right? So they're just about to come into the Holy Land. And so what's happened in the generation since then is that now they've taken possession of some piece of it. That they don't have all of it. We'll see that in the next chapter. But that they have a good chunk of it. That they've seen God win these military victories that they should never have been able to win. That they've seen God chase out the kings from before them. They've seen God change the... I guess it was the Wednesday morning study. We were talking about Balaam a little bit. Where one of the pagan kings calls in this pagan prophet to curse the Israelites. And you get the famous story of Balaam's donkey in Numbers 23, maybe, if y'all want to look at that later. Numbers 22 and 23. And so God basically comes to this prophet and tells him, no, you're not to go do this. and over time, he actually changes the prophet's mind. Through that particular story, you have an angel who appears in the way and the donkey won't go, and so he just starts beating the donkey, and eventually the donkey starts talking to him, and then he sees the angel standing there with the sword to kill him, basically. And so from that point, then he goes on and winds up blessing the Israelites in the presence of the pagan king. And so the Israelites have seen all of this. And so then we get to this point in the story where Joshua dies. And now we don't have a single leader for the Israelites anymore. As we go into the book of Judges. Similarly, we see that they followed God for the time that Joshua lived. They followed God for the time that the elders and the others who had seen all of this that God had wrought in the conquest lived. And it doesn't go past that, but it does tell us that they were faithful for that chunk of time. And then since we read it, I will go ahead and highlight then in verse 32, we see that they buried the bones of Joseph from all the way back in Genesis 50. So that Joseph then at least is buried in the promised land. So as we move forward into Judges, the next passage we're going to look at is actually Judges. I rearranged this just a little bit as I'm going here. And I'm probably going to regret that. Let's look at Judges 2 and start in verse 6. And we see, when Joshua had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went each to his inheritance to possess the land. The people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who had survived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Should sound familiar. Then Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the territory of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. All that generation also were gathered to their fathers, and there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. Kind of an interesting note. And so we get the beginning of this cycle that we're going to look at here in Judges. But one of the things that I think you see is that you have this generation that is viewed as faithful, and they're viewed as seeing the works of the Lord. They've seen all of this. And yet somehow that doesn't pass down. whether that's lack of discipleship or simply lack of God's revelation. It somehow or another, it doesn't translate. And so we see then this next generation begins to fall away from the Lord and begins to go after the Baals and the Ashtaroth and all of this. And that's we over and over and over again throughout the book of Judges. Before we get there, though, I want to go back just a little bit and look at, well, how did the conquest go? How did it work out? And we looked at this a little bit a couple weeks ago, but we're going to hit it a little bit heavier here today. And so we're going to start with Judges 1, and we'll read verses 1 to 26 or so. I don't know that we necessarily have to read all of that, but would somebody like to read verses 1 to 10? I know there's some fun names in there. Rick, you want to hit them for us? Yeah. Thank you. So, what do we see in that passage? Yep, certainly an interesting illustration. If we look big picture, though, one of the things we see is that the conquest seems to be going well, right? Where we're talking about all these things where they're able to capture the land that they're promised. So far, so good, right? Doesn't last long. So if we start in verse 11, anybody else want to read the funny names? Okay. Start in verse 11. Then from there he went against the inhabitants of Debir. Now the name of Debir formerly was Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "The one who attacks Kiriath Sefer and captures it, I will even give him my daughter Aksa for a wife." Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, captured it, so he gave him his daughter Aksa for a wife. Then it came about, when she came to him, that she persuaded him to ask her father for a field. And then she alighted... Let's skip a little bit. So we get more captures of cities. And let's actually skip down to verse 27. We'll make this a little bit faster. So we see, but Manasseh did not take possession of Beth Shean and its villages, or Taanach and its villages, or the inhabitants of Dor and its villages, or the inhabitants of Ibleam and its villages, or the inhabitants of Megiddo and its villages. So the Canaanites persisted in living in that land. It came about when Israel became strong that they put the Canaanites to forced labor, but they did not drive them out completely. Ephraim did not drive out the Canaanites who were living in Gezer, so the Canaanites lived in Gezer among them. Zebulun did not drive out the inhabitants of Kitron or the inhabitants of Nahalol, so the Canaanites lived among them and became subject to forced labor. Asher did not drive out the inhabitants of Akko or the inhabitants of Sidon or of Alab or of Achzib or of Helba or of Aphek or of Rehob. So the Ashdorites lived among the Canaanites, the inhabitants of the land, for they did not drive them out. We get several more verses like that. But the point is that Israel has not been faithful in carrying out the conquest, in part. Part of it is also that Israel has not completed the conquest, that they haven't driven these people out. They don't hold all the land that they were promised. And they're being unfaithful already. And so shortly thereafter then, we see, this would be verse... Let's try 2, 11 to 15. I don't think there are any funny names in this one. Somebody want to read this chunk? Joshua 2, 11 to 15. Meredith? I skipped a little bit ahead of where I meant to have you read, but yeah, that works. So the part I was going to have you read, sorry, verse 2, or starting in at verse 1 of chapter 2. So the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim, and he said, I brought you up out of Egypt and led you into the land which I have sworn to your fathers. And I said, I will never break my covenant with you. And as for you, you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars, but you have not obeyed me. What is this you have done? Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, but they will become as thorns in your side, and their gods will be a snare to you. When the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and wept. So they named that place Bochim, and there they sacrificed to the Lord. So they didn't complete the conquest. So God cursed them such that they will not complete the conquest. They didn't drive out these other gods and these people who worship the other gods. And so God has cursed them that those will become snares for them. Actually, we see that back even in that story of Balaam I was talking about. And so we get... The Israelites are not faithful, and so God then curses them into further unfaithfulness. Anita? A lot of it was... Yeah, so we don't know for all of the cities. Some of them it does tell us though. So if we read through the book of Joshua in particular, goes into this. You have one city that basically takes moldy bread and whatnot and pretends like they're from far off and makes a covenant with the Israelites, despite the fact that they basically live right outside of Jerusalem. And the Israelites never double check it. They never check with God. They never do anything. They just make a covenant with them, and then once the covenant's made, they won't break it. So in some cases, it's trickery. In other cases, I think you just get the sense that they didn't feel the need. The Canaanites are willing to go into forced labor, things like that, where the Israelites don't feel the need to be faithful to what God has called them to as far as holy war in this particular context. So they don't bring God's judgment in the way that God tells them to. I think so. On the one hand, yes. On the one hand, yes. On the other hand, I think it's a lack of understanding of, or not even a lack of understanding, a lack of remembering, a lack of keeping in mind what God tells them. So, I mean, God tells them in Deuteronomy, you've got just pages and pages of curses that will happen if they're not faithful to the covenant. And it basically outlines everything that we see through the exile. And yet they don't do it. I mean, I think a lot of it is kind of, so like when, as Christians, we sin. We don't necessarily sin because we think this is okay. We just kind of forget that it's not. And forget even is a kind of a nice term, if you know what I mean. Tom? Yeah. Not at all. Especially if some of them do or are inclined to surrender. No. On the one hand, yes. And on the other hand, there comes a point where God does that. I mean, I think that's kind of what Romans 1 teaches. I'll just flip there real quick. So like Romans 1, starting at verse 18, we see, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures." And then we see, "Therefore God gave them over in the lusts of their heart to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them." So they chose to exchange God for something else, and so God gave them over to it at some point. And so on the one hand, we see this judgment where basically they're given over to what it is they already want to do, whether it's here in Judges or it's there in Romans. And yet on the other hand, there is something of this. Let them experience the, you know, you get the 1 Corinthians 5, for example, where Paul says, basically, throw the man outside of the church. Deliver him over to Satan that he may be saved in the last day, basically. And so there is some of that. Let him see the consequences of his actions so that he sees his need for something else. His glory. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and even in that example, you get sometimes we were told that Pharaoh hardened his own heart, and other times we're told that God hardens his heart. And so again, it's kind of God giving him over to what he already wants to do. Yeah. So there begins the cycle of the judges. I mean, we see this cycle over and over and over again, where we have this faithful generation, it doesn't last, and so they fall. And in falling, they fall to a point where they invite God's anger, because God dwells among them. And eventually there's people will rise up at the direction of God to trouble the Israelites. And we'll look at a couple of examples here in a moment. And so people rise up and they trouble the Israelites until the Israelites repent. They call out to God for rescue. At which point God appoints a judge, hence the name of the book, who then comes in and rescues Israel as God's representative in some special way. So we just read 2:11 to 15, where we see that Israel serves the Baals. So if we pick up in verse, let's pick up in verse 15, just so we remember. We see that wherever they went, the hand of the Lord was against them for evil, as the Lord had spoken and as the Lord had sworn to them, so that they were severely distressed. Then the Lord raised up judges who delivered them from the hands of those who plundered them. So they see rescue. And then in verse 17, yet they did not listen to their judges, for they played the harlot after other gods and bowed themselves down to them. They turned aside quickly from the way in which their fathers had walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do as their fathers. When the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge and delivered them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who had oppressed and afflicted them. But it came about when the judge died that they would turn back and act more corruptly than their fathers in following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not abandon their practices or their stubborn ways. So the anger of the Lord burned against Israel. And he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant, which I commanded their fathers, and has not listened to my voice, I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died. In order to test Israel by them, whether they will keep the way of the Lord and walk in it as their fathers did or not. So the Lord allowed those nations to remain, not driving them out quickly, and he did not give them into the hand of Joshua. So, overall, Judges is not a particularly happy book, right? I mean, there's some of the, if you're talking about some of the most memorable stories, they're right here in Judges. But what you see is that everything, you kind of get this spiral effect. And yet every time we make that circle, everything is a little bit worse. And it's a little bit worse, and it's a little bit worse. And so you wind up with this cycle. So depravity reigns, right? You get this refrain that Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And then you get the story. You get the refrain, in those days, there was no king in Israel. And you get the story. And at the very end of the book, you get, it actually gives you kind of a more complete, I think it, the point is that this is the whole statement, is that you see that in those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. And that's the last line of the book. And so depravity reigns in some sense. We get this rebellion, or relapse, or however you want to say it, where the people don't do what they're supposed to do. They don't follow God's covenant. They don't serve the Lord. They seek after these other gods. And one point I guess I should make here too is that what's in view here is not necessarily a wholehearted departure from God. There's this term called syncretism. And basically what syncretism is it's taking a little bit from here and a little bit from there and a little bit from over there and combining it all. So that it's not a wholesale departure from serving the God of Israel. It's serving God and the Baals, God and the Asherah, it's not a wholesale departure even. It's lack of covenant faithfulness, lack of recognition that the Lord is God, the only God. And because of Israel's rebellion, of this turning away, the Lord brings judgment. And frequently that's in the form of either uprisings in the land, or it's in the form of the Philistines, or it's in the form of one of the other nations that's surrounding the people, coming in and attacking the people. And so there's military consequences. And eventually Israel begs for release. They're brought to the fact that they've done wrong. And so God brings up a judge. And so, actually, let me just ask this. Can anybody remember some judges? Deborah? Yep, Gideon. Very good. Samson, very good. Yeah. So we've got quite a number of them. Samson's a pretty interesting case too, because in some sense, Samson, I think it actually, let's talk about Samson for a moment, because I think it shows that spiral pretty well. So the judge is God's representative in some special way, right? He's the person that God is working through. So what would you expect to see of this person? You know, like, would you expect this person to be, particularly moral, per se? would you expect them to be someone who follows the law of God? Maybe. That's not Samson. He had the long hair. He did follow that one. so he's a Nazarite. He is dedicated from his birth as a Nazarite. And so while other Israelites could take a Nazarite vow, where they would essentially live like the priests for a year, and they could do it, I believe, once. Samson was supposed to be doing that for the entirety of his life. But he didn't. So you get these stories like Samson slaying the Philistines, an army of Philistines, with the jawbone of a donkey. But you're not supposed to touch dead things. we get these stories like Samson going and marrying a Philistine girl, despite the fact that you're not supposed to be marrying outside of the covenant people of God. We get these stories like Samson shacking up with prostitutes. Obviously not good. And yet, this is the person that God has elected to make a judge. Which should tell us a little something, probably, about the state of Israel at that time. Yeah. Yeah. For sure. And yet, it's also, I think, illustrative of this spiral where God can't even find, or God isn't even finding, that the holiest of holy people is not all that holy. and is getting worse to the point where you get to the end of Judges, and we're not even going to read those in here. They're just bad. I mean, they're very illustrative, but they're very difficult to talk about. And so you get this repentance, and you get this judge who comes forth, and he rescues the people. And so again, we see God's rescue mediated through an individual. It's a pattern we see over and over and over again as we run through the Old Testament, whether it's here with the judges or in the future here with the kings. Again, you get this special representative of God, the prophets. And so I think it'll probably be helpful if we just highlight, I'll give you kind of Sproul's little mnemonic device here. So he likes to talk about four R's. I think it's helpful to kind of remember it a little bit. So he talks about relapse, where the people at the end of the judge or during the judge's time, the people are following God, kind of, and then they relapse. And so, because they relapse, God brings retribution, and eventually, that retribution has enough of an impact on the people then that they repent. And then people repent, then God brings forth a judge to rescue his people. Clear as mud? Okay. And then it happens over and over and over again. So, chapter 2, verse 11, we see, "Then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals." I found these really easily the other day at the table. There's one right at the beginning of Deborah, here in chapter 4. Oh, verse 1. "Then the sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died." 6, at the beginning of Gideon. "The sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord gave them into the hands of Midian 7 years. So sometimes these were pretty lasting judgments, at least by temporal standpoint. Yeah, and so it keeps coming until eventually we hit, in those days there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Yeah. Well, in the sense that God was supposed to be the king of Israel, there was, and I think that to some degree that's telling. They had no king like the nations. Although I think in part that statement is looking at the rebellion of Israel and saying that Israel is not even recognizing God as the rightful king. Yeah. You going to say something? And I mean, the book of Judges spans like 300-350 years. I mean, it's not a short period of time. I mean, this is basically goes from American history standpoint, pre-revolution to now. It's a long period of time. And yet, we get that very clear trend. During this time, just because this study is supposed to be on kingship, at the same time that we have Judges going on, we have Ruth, or we have the story of Ruth. And I'm not gonna go through Ruth in any kind of detail here, but I do want to highlight a note at the very end. And so we'll look at Ruth 14 and or Ruth 4. Too many verses and chapters. starting at verse 18. Or actually, let's start at verse 16. Chapter 4. Not 14. Got a couple extra chapters in my Bible. I don't know. So, starting at verse 16, or chapter 4, verse 16, we see, "Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. The neighbor women gave him a name, saying, 'A son has been born to Naomi.' So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now these are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron, and to Hezron was born Ram, and to Ram, Amminadab, and to Amminadab was born Nashon, and to Nashon, Salmon, and to Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz, Obed, and to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse, David." So, obviously we have a genealogy here, right? Everybody's favorite part of the Bible. If you guys remember back, when we talked a minute about genealogies, I told you there were two types that we found in Genesis. Does this remind you of either type? Talked about specific versus general genealogies. Okay. This one in particular kind of picks up on some of those specific genealogies that we just talked about. So it starts with Perez. Why does it start with Perez? Oh boy. I wish I had written down the verse that's in, or the chapter that's in. Whose son is Perez? Does anybody remember that? It's okay. His father is Judah. There's a story in Genesis 40. Seven, I think, 48. No, I'm too late. Here. Yeah. No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It kind of comes down to family structure. So, do you have a clear way of explaining this? I can. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes, basically. Yeah. 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 So if you go back and you look through a lot of the genealogies and whatnot, you see this word that gets, the King James translates it begat. It doesn't necessarily mean a father-son relationship in the way that we think about it. Kind of like Jesus can say that, or all of the Jews would say that they were Abraham's son. It can be, yeah. Yeah, it's a little bit looser of a connection, but yes. Yeah, it would basically be like a grandson. Yeah, for Perez, that's true. Perez, that goes back to the story I'm trying to find here real quick in Genesis. And it's kind of the low point of Judah's life, basically. Where Judah has a series of sons, and the oldest one marries this woman. He dies. No heirs. And so then the brother winds up marrying the wife. Leveret marriage is what it's called. The brother dies. And so then he only has one son left. And so he doesn't want to marry her to this son because the other ones have all died when they married her. And yet he's technically bound to give her this son as well. And so anyways, she winds up basically pretending to be a prostitute on the side of the road. He winds up seeking her services. She has twins. One of them is Perez. Yeah. And that story is in, I'll have to get back with you on where that story is. I got to wrap this up. But what we see is that Perez comes from the line of Judah. And we talked about before that Judah is the line of this promised seed that goes all the way back to Abraham. Goes through Isaac and through Jacob and through Judah. And so we're picking up that same thing in Ruth, where we've now got this line of the promised seed that lands us at David. And that name should be familiar because that's King David, later known as. And then as we keep moving forward, we see that Christ is identified as the greater David. He's the descendant of David. It's the point of the genealogies that we find in Matthew 1 and Luke 2 or 3. And so we get this line of the promised seed that God is using in some special way to rescue his people as his mediator. Yeah. And so as we're moving on, next time we're going to look a little bit at the life of Samuel. And particularly we're looking at Samuel so that we can look at Saul and David. And we get this great contrast set up between the first king, who's really kind of the epitome of a bad king, and David, who is the man after God's own heart and is kind of the illustration that we find throughout the rest of the scriptures of what a good king is. He has his downfalls, but yeah. So that's where we're going to be going. If you want to do a little bit of homework for next week, I'd look at kind of the first few chapters of 1 Samuel. And yeah, so let's close out with prayer. Father, thank you.